I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. With multiple TV news outlets, an increasing number of talk radio options, and numerous online sites, our options for news and information are endless. But quantity doesn't mean quality. How do we decipher credible news sources? What's biased? What's not? And what is complete fabrication? In this age of alternative facts and so-called fake news, there are new challenges not only for journalists, but news consumers. We'll also look this morning at how to best educate the next generation of journalists and media consumers. Joining us in studio is Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mindy.
Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mindy.
And on the phone, Al Tompkins, senior faculty in broadcast and online at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, a nonprofit school for journalism. Good morning, Al. Al, are you there? All right, well, Dan works on getting Al. Let's start with this view of this term fake news. Is this something new?
Well, that's what's interesting. It's not something new, I think, at all. It's something that we've been seeing for many, many years. I think there's a heightened awareness of it, of course, in the current administration and environment that we're in. And we can talk a little bit about that. But I think this has gone back a long way. In fact, I was just reflecting on some comments I've made in speeches, going back 10 or so years, and the discussion of fake news always comes up. And I remember in 2010, Bill Keller, who then was the editor of the New York Times, talked about a fire hose of misinformation that was out there in the blogosphere and how the so-called legitimate media, the mainstream media, had to combat that. So it's not a new phenomenon. And at the same time, I think that there is something new about what we're seeing today.
Right. Do we have Al? Al, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Al. So what's your thought on this term fake news? As Paul was just saying, it's not really a new thing, but it seems to be heightened. A lot of people are more aware of it, I think, than they ever were before.
Well, I think what's happened is we've sort of used that word to encompass a lot of things. Up until about 2 weeks ago, I hated this phrase. Then I sort of had an epiphany that there actually is something called fake news. There is actually content that is whole cloth untrue, and the people who generate it mean for it to be untrue. It's not just a misstatement or a miscalculation. It is usually motivated by politics or by money. I want to trick you into clicking on something or reading something. And then there's a third category, and it may be the most damaging of all, and that is those who would just seek to create chaos. And for no particular financial or political gain, they just want to stir things up. And there's a lot of that as well. So there is actually something around this term fake news, which is different from news that I just disagree with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After Trump's inauguration, a reporter from Time reported that the bust of Martin Luther King Jr. had been removed from the Oval Office. He later tweeted an apology and correction. The bust had been obscured by a door. But he was called out by the White House as disseminating fake news. But there's a difference between fake news and mistakes in reporting. We all make mistakes in reporting. Sean, you want to address that?
Well, I think the difference is intent. You know, in one case, an effort's being made to spread misinformation. In another, the effort is to gather and disseminate truthful and accurate information. And so you want to find a news source that generates corrections and not just when threatened by a lawsuit. So legacy news organizations have prided themselves on being the sources of record, and I think they still do. So they want to make corrections. They want to keep things accurate. They see themselves as the first line of history. So when journalists make mistakes, they correct them. But, an upstanding nonpartisan journalist talk about this stuff a lot. But that doesn't happen. The people fabricating news stories purposefully, they didn't go to journalism school. It's kind of a dirty business. There's really no effort to clean things up and make sure things are done above board and accurately.
I think there's been a sort of a broad brush of this fake news, and Al sort of broke it down pretty well. And the example that Sean uses is an excellent one of simply a mistake with Time Magazine. But my take on that is, yes, it was a mistake, but it just illustrates how careful the legitimate media has to be, because you do get that pulled into this concept of full-on fake news, and it really does great damage to our industry's credibility. It helps allow for the delegitimization of our business. And how often after that mistake happened, a legitimate mistake that was corrected almost immediately, did you hear the Trump administration bang that drum throughout the weekend on the morning shows, throughout the next week, and even to this day, it still comes up as an example of the mainstream media being out to get the Trump administration and the so-called war that the administration has declared on us. So even though it was not fake news per se, I think it's one of the issues that we face as a business, and it's why we have to be so careful now more than ever to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Al, you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying my father used to say, that you make your reputation over time and you lose it overnight, and it's not even overnight now. So any affirmation that there is to the idea that you can't trust information from news sources that you normally disagree with will make you feel more strongly in that direction. Look, we can't convince you, nobody can convince you that something is reliable if you don't believe it's reliable. You'll always be able to find something in the nuance of words or phrases, or you didn't cover this the way you covered that. You can't convince somebody like that. We probably shouldn't try, but what we ought to do is try to do our job well. My guess is that most of your listeners, and most people generally in the United States, really don't want to hear us trying to defend ourselves and convincing you that we are really careful. It's sort of like the president saying the other day, I'm a really nice guy. Well, if you already believe that, you already believe that. If you don't, you won't. So get on with it. Just, you know, do your job, cover news that's important, and get on with it. And to me, it's time to just stop all of this no, I'm not, yes, you are stuff. There's too much news going on that needs to be covered.
You know, we hear a lot of stories of younger people turning to some of the comedy shows for their news. So let's talk about the difference between fake news and parody and satire. I mean, this Saturday Night Live ratings have gone through the roof with this.
Yeah, well, and of course, Saturday Night Live, and then there's The Daily Show, and there's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which I think has become enormously popular over the past year or so, and in particular during the election cycle. Interesting, John Oliver was on hiatus from, I think, right around after Election Day to just this past weekend. So when he came back on, he said, I wonder what's been happening. It was interesting. Those are comedy shows. They're, you know, and as you said, they're parodies. They don't, you know, try to be the news per se, or at least not the news without a bit of a slant. And yet, at the same time, we've seen for a number of years now a troubling number of particularly young people who do turn to that as a primary news source. When Jon Stewart was at The Daily Show, The Daily Show was considered by younger folks to be essential in terms of providing news. And I think that's a little bit troubling as well, because, you know, they are not trying to be a fact-based, full and fair news source. They're trying to be funny, and they're trying to put a spin on something intentionally. And so, you know, the key there is that people need to be, go ahead and watch The Daily Show or Last Week Tonight or Saturday Night Live, but make sure that that's not your only source for information.
Parody, comedy, literature, theater, music, these have all been long time, centuries of experience in talking about difficult things like politics. So in that way, it's just carrying on the tradition. Right. Brain scientists would tell you that one reason that these are such useful delivery vehicles is because we all experience information different ways. Those of us, you know, who have raised children know that you can sometimes teach children through music or by play in ways that you can't by just sort of rote learning. So people take in information in all sorts of ways, and theater and parody and comedy, cartoons, editorial cartoons. These are all different ways that we express sometimes really important ideas.
So, right, satire, no intention of harm there. We need to think about the motive and who's creating this content and why. But it's also important to kind of think about the ways you're seeing this false content come at you. In some cases, they're leaving a real news story there and only changing the headline, or they're manipulating a photo. So if you go and read, it seems very, very legitimate. Sometimes, again, it's the imagery that's being manipulated to deceive, or it's really they're fabricating something out of whole cloth. So it's very subversive, and even really media savvy people can have trouble and have to go and take a look. So I've kind of come down where, well, if I see it in one place, I kind of hold off. And if I start to see it showing the same type of story showing up again with in a legitimate trusted source in my mind, then that's when I start to really believe that this is the truth here.
Yeah. Bringing up a good point. I'm just thinking, even on Facebook, sometimes you'll see something. And it looks like I saw something and it was a story on Melania Trump, and it had the whole Fox News, and it clearly was not a Fox News story. I looked at this and it had her a quote, which clearly was not a quote from her. And I thought, that can't be real. And of course you look, and as you look, if it's Fox TV, why wasn't an audio clip? You know, but I'm thinking that. But there are a lot of people who might look at that and go, oh my gosh, that's real news. So maybe it's helpful if we explain a little bit about the journalistic process. Journalists pride themselves in getting the facts right and covering an issue from more than one single perspective. So describe the steps that reporters take to cover a story and fact check to make sure they're getting the right information out there. How does it, bring us through the process, Paul?
Well, I mean, to start with, you know, reporters and editors have to be politically agnostic. You know, they don't really care where the story lands. You know, that's not their objective, even though, of course, and this is nothing new. Again, you know, there are people who are going to be upset if the story is, quote, negative for one side or the other, whether Republican or Democrat or whatever it might be, you know, wherever it lands, someone's going to be upset. And that's the old axiom, right, that if you're making someone mad, you're probably doing your job right.
And if you're making both sides mad,
you're really doing your job right. But from a reporter and an editor standpoint, a journalist standpoint, they don't care. They're just going to pursue the facts and as fully and fairly as possible. And the goal is not only to hear a story that's a good scoop and you know, and to run with it, but to then hear the other side, to try to flesh it out, to try to add a context and a perspective to what is being said. So it's not just reported in a vacuum. And increasingly in this 24/7 environment, that can become difficult. And yet, as I said earlier, it's truly essential today more than ever to maintain our credibility, to do it right. And so you do take very careful and deliberate steps toward your reporting. As Sean said before, you know, honest mistakes happen, but you don't have to wait for someone to threaten a lawsuit or even erase the mistake. If you know, you correct it right away. But the goal is to try to get it right and get it right the first time. And that's not what everyone out there is doing. And so, you know, I think, you know, for us as an industry, we're in it for the long game. And you know, there might be periods of time, and there always have been periods of time where we're fallen under criticism. Certainly that's the case now. But if we just keep the blinders on and continue to do our job well, I think we'll come out of this just fine.
I think it's impossible for journalists to pretend that they don't care. And more than that, I don't think our listeners and viewers and readers believe that we don't care. I care. We all have opinions. Mindy and I worked together in another lifetime years ago, and you know, she knows that that we're all a product of who we are and how we were brought up, and so on. The key to me is whether I can cover a story and cover it fairly. It's not that I don't care. It's that my job is to try to give people an honest hearing and to try to render the facts as cleanly as possible. And when you read it or listen to it or watch it, you know, can you detect what you think my bias is? There is a line of thought, and it's an interesting one. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think it's an interesting line of thought that we ought not pretend that we don't care, that we ought to disclose our biases in the way that financial reporters, for example, have to disclose whether or not they have an investment in something they're covering. It's an interesting idea. The fact is that each one of us, though, have biases. The challenge is to report around those biases and to try to find ways to tell the story that's even-handed. So I think most people don't believe that we're not biased, that we don't have some feeling about something. And I think it's too much to ask for us as opinionated and reasonably informed people not to have some opinion.
I know we're going to be taking a break soon, so maybe we can take the break on a positive note. You know, America has been through these types of down trusting media points before. Yellow journalism of the late 1800s, really influential on the Spanish-American War. People could see it in their papers as papers competed to be more sensationalistic to get more of an audience. And what came out of that was an effort on the part of audiences to find legitimate sources that weren't sensational. And out of that came the New York Times. And Adolph Oakes really, that was his point. I need to have fact-based information that investors and people of stature can make legitimate decisions about their lives and about policy, rather than something that's just based on sensationalism. So that was a result of that awful time in American journalism, and perhaps we'll find our way through this.
We're talking about journalism and fake news with Sean Corker, news director at WCAI, Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief at the Cape Cod Times, and Al Tompkins, senior faculty in broadcast and online at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about journalism and fake news with Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI, Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief at the Cape Cod Times, Al Tompkins, senior faculty in broadcast and online at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Al, has your methodology for teaching the next crop of journalists changed? I mean, I would imagine it's always kind of tweaking it somewhat, right?
Yeah, well, it's more than a tweak. It the way that they gather, the way that they verify, obviously is different than it was when you and I were young reporters. We'd go out and talk to people and search through paper records, and it's very different now, obviously. An awful lot of what journalists now come to report comes to them from social media or from people sending them things. And the other thing that's very different now than was when you and I were young on the street is that the pressure to turn stories is so great. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get very little time on the local level particularly, but on the national level too, you get very little time to verify stories and to really generate new information. And so the problem comes in having the time to be able to go through the information and to try to fact check it, to try to make it even-handed, to try to generate new information, because you're constantly filing. And it's not an excuse any more than an excuse in an emergency room or for your, you know, hairdresser. I mean, your hairdresser doesn't get a break if they say, look, I'm really in a hurry today. I've got a lot of people. You don't give them a break, and we shouldn't give journalists a break either. What we need are greater skills and much more awareness. What I think of as critical thinking skills is one of the things that I teach an awful lot of these days is how to look at information and make sense of it. Because I think journalism today has largely evolved from fact-telling to sense-making. But it's in that sense-making role where biases tend to seep out more easily. And that's one of the skills, though, that I wish we would spend a lot more time on is making sense. It's what public radio does so beautifully is it spends a lot less time covering issues and events and a lot more time sorting through what we think we know and what it means.
Yeah. Let's talk to Dana, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. I totally agree with that last point about critical thinking. I think it should be a core education requirement from third grade to freshman year in college. However, I would disagree with the fact that NPR, at least the flagship, Washington-based, I'm not talking about the local, but is not, it does a good job of that. During the whole Iraq war, I was sending Scott Simon get well cards for his war fever affliction, which kind of caught on. I mean, we never heard any anti-war voices. We had talk call-in show, Talk of the Nation, based on how can the U.S. win in Afghanistan instead of asking, should the U.S. be in Afghanistan militarily? Also, NPR is very notorious for pushing commercial culture, pushing products, and I could cite examples of that if you want.
And Dana, we've heard many of those examples from you, and I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts as always. And thanks.
Can I say a word about that?
Sure, go ahead.
What Dana says though is there's a great truth in what he says. in this way, and that is that it's really difficult for journalists to give voice to opposition and not get over, just overrun by opponents. And I think that while I would disagree with Dana that opposition voices weren't given a voice, of course they were, but if we look back over time, and we've done this, if you look back over time to how we treated anti-war voices, for example, in Vietnam and the early days of Iraq, and you could go through history and find this, I think that he would be right that over time, we don't give those opposition voices a lot of voice, or at least serious voice, but we do give the voice of the government, the pro-intervention voice, much more prominence and much more weight. And then as time goes on, the opposition voices seem to be more reasonable and seem, maybe we should have paid more attention to what they were saying and so on. Protest is part of the American culture. I was teaching a group of Moldovan journalists yesterday, and they were very interested in the idea of loud, aggressive parade marches on President's Day. They were fascinated by that, and they wondered how much press would be given to them. And to them, the whole concept of the American protest that is covered as news was a fascinating concept. And I think that for us, we ought to value the idea of covering protest, because protest forces us into examination. So we cover it not to agree with it, but we cover it in order to answer the questions that are being raised in the protest.
Mm, good point. Dana, thanks for the call. Joining us on the phone is Allison Butler, director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program in the Department of Communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Allison, how do most of your students get their news?
Most of my students get their news from social media, if they get it at all. It's something we talk about in my classes a lot. They're exhausted, and I teach mostly juniors and seniors, and a lot of them are saying that they don't know what to believe. Everything sounds terrible. They're terrified to graduate, and so they turn it off a lot, or they rely on scrolling through Facebook for headlines. And then they come to my class and have a very different experience.
So how do they tend to verify or vet their information? Do they?
I think that they're of at least two minds of it. If they're on their own, sort of scrolling through Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat, they're scrolling. But they're also really smart individuals, and they come to class and are willing to do the work. So part of what I'm trying to do is get them to carry that work outside of the classroom, beyond just where we are inside of those walls, and to say, hey, this is something that's happening everywhere. I mean, in listening to the conversation thus far, it's so important to hear the history, the way that newspapers came about, or the way that trusted journalism came about, how to approach stories in a responsible way, recognizing bias, et cetera. And one of the things that I try and point out to my students is this isn't starting today. You know, for many of them, this was the first election that they voted in. So they think of it as beginning right now. And so I try and bring some of that history and some of that timeline in to say, we've seen something like this before. How can we learn from this? How can we look at our larger context instead of looking at just what's on our screen?
So how do you help them differentiate between real and fake news?
Part of the majority of the work that I do is in critical media literacy. And what we're looking at in critical media literacy is, to some extent, less about answering questions, although, of course, that's hugely important. But it's really focused on asking questions. So to try and get them to ask the questions of what they're seeing, who made this? How was it made? How do we know that? What is the intended audience? And then to really kind of do the best that we can to study behind the scenes, right? Who owns this? Who produced it? Who distributed it? For what purpose? So that we can kind of trace both a timeline as well as a responsibility line to see where these stories are coming from, and to the best of our ability, what their intended purpose is. Hmm.
So are you finding your students generally skeptical or trusting of what they read or see online?
Skeptical.
Skeptical, yeah.
Yep.
So
they're skeptical.
So what could we learn from how the next generation is consuming information that might better equip us to slow the proliferation of fake news?
I think think it's, I mean, I think it's exactly that, that we have to slow down. So much comes to us so quickly and so easily. And I do a little project in one of my classes where I ask them to document their media use for 24 hours. And they come to class sort of heads hanging in shame because they don't recognize how much media they are engaging until they have to write it down. And, you know, they hand me these pieces of paper with, you know, notes scratched all over them, 24 hours of, oh my God, I checked Facebook again, or I was on Twitter, or I didn't even realize how much time went by. So part of it, I think, is taking a step back and acknowledging how much media we are exposed to and how much of it we're actually closely paying attention to. And part of critical media literacy is very much about slowing down our consumption and asking those questions and then trying to figure out what value is in this. And that value doesn't necessarily mean what we agree with. We can disagree with something and it can still be valid. But how did these stories come to us? What is their information? What are their sources? And I think a special caveat for this administration is to recognize that one of the things that we've seen is that this administration demands 100% loyalty. So I'm wondering if we're going to be seeing more anonymous sources who are trying to protect their jobs and still give information. So what does it mean to be a named source versus an anonymous source? Mm-hmm. And what language is being used? What is the emphasis? Is it inflammatory? Is it appealing to our emotions? Is it fact-based? How do we begin to evaluate the word choices, the language that's coming to us, both visually and in words? What do these pictures look like that before we even read the content or listen to the content, we're seeing an image that is going to be flattering or unflattering, and is most likely these days incredibly emotionally based? Because that's part of what's going on with this post-truth and fake news and alternative facts, is that it's appealing to our emotions.
Sean?
Well, there's a lot there to kind of drill down into, but I want to go back to what she said about slowing down. I like that advice, slowing down as you're scrolling through your social media, because every time you pass along a piece of information without double checking, when you pass along the unverified news story or photo, you're part of the problem. I'm part of the problem. So we need to verify it ourselves, whatever is coming across our computer screen, before we disseminate it. And so, you know, recognize that these sites are not always out there vetting things, or only go to sites that you know do have a process in place. But at the same time, so that this new kind of distribution of news, this new way to distribute news is part of our issue here. But at the same time, it offers opportunities for journalists to do things that weren't always easy to do before, like put out the information of the primary sources of information that our stories are built upon, and more opportunities to fact check, more opportunities to interact with the audience and make corrections when necessary, or with sources that you maybe didn't get to on the first pass, but see what you have written because of its distribution, and then have a conversation. And can we add to the story that way?
Yeah. Paul, you wanted to add something.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, so many things, but the one thing I wanted to put to Allison, you know, one thing about digital media today, you know, we have the power to be better informed, deeper informed than ever before. Information is literally at our fingertips within fractions of seconds. So we could be very informed. And I think we all, or at least I certainly believe that, in fact, it's the opposite. People are becoming more and more shallow informed because they are looking simply to support what their preconceived notions are, rather than to go challenge themselves, to inform themselves. They're going to look for ammo to back up an argument. And there's this concept called confirmation bias. So do you get into that with your classroom, and what do you tell them?
Yeah, we do, definitely. I mean, I think part of it is when they bring that stuff to the discussion, I often think about asking them and myself, et cetera, all of us, to kind of step back and ask who our gatekeepers are. Because I think gatekeeping has changed a lot these days. And it's the idea that they read it on the internet, so therefore it must be true, is something that I think I'm definitely working on challenging. And it's really, I mean, we're all in it. Like, this is the thing with sort of media literacy, is the more media literate we are, it doesn't necessarily mean the more immune we are. In some ways, we start to see it. And And, you know, I mean, right before the election and certainly around the inauguration, I was exhausted by the amount of information that was out there. And I was kind of craving a little confirmation bias of, like, I can't believe what is happening. Let me kind of find my way back into a safe, warm, dark spot. And yet we have to come out of that. And so it's to say that they are definitely being exposed to repeated information that either already fulfills what they believe, or because it doesn't, they think, therefore, it might not be true. And so we spend a lot of time talking about what does it mean to get this information, right? It's, I mean, it's a pretty clear narrative these days that our social media follow algorithms where they're giving us information that we already agree with. So how do we then seek out information that we disagree with, or that we might not be exposed to? How do we go somewhere else other than what comes to us? So in addition to sort of the slowing down that I was saying before, it's also we have to seek out differently. We have to explore our news, our media environment in a different way, maybe do a little bit more work or a little bit of different work in order to try and get a fuller picture. And we also spend a lot of time talking about what the motivation of mainstream or corporate media is, which is profit. And keeping us isolated, keeping us slightly less informed, keeping us with a thin layer of information can be profitable for corporate media.
Al, what are your thoughts?
Well, I want to speak to that, having worked for corporate media and worked in corporate media for a lot of my life. There's nothing about being corporately owned that makes you evil unless you have an evil corporation. I work with some of the biggest news sources on the planet, and what I come in contact with there are people who try very hard to get the story right. Mm-hmm. So I've worked, and probably most of you have, I've worked for small owners, I've worked for large owners, and one is not, in my experience, not more evil than another. I would also draft off of this idea of changing your mind or being open to alternative pieces of information. It seems to me, and I could be just fantasy, but it seems to me there might have been a time when the sign of wisdom was that when confronted with facts that were new to you, you might be open to adopting those facts and changing your mind. And for whatever reason, it seems to me to be out of fashion to change your mind about anything these days. In fact, it's a sign of weakness. I think that it could be so much more productive if we made it safe for people to change their mind about important things when confronted with new facts. You wouldn't become intractable on things about inoculations or climate change or you name it. If you could allow yourself to say, you know what, I hadn't thought of it that way. I'm thinking differently about it now, and not be called a flip-flopper and not be penalized politically, not be laughed at by your friends. It seems to me that enlightenment has something to do with I'm open to the facts however I find them, and society just punishes you when you do that now.
I don't think that it's people don't see themselves as open-minded. I think people generally do see themselves as open-minded and willing to change based on facts presented to them, but I think part of the problem is now algorithms are deciding what facts are coming at you. Mm-hmm. And you've decided you're going to trust certain sources which are only going to give you a certain perspective. So you're not getting the different perspectives. Even I'm very frustrated with my own Facebook and Twitter feed, well, primarily Facebook, because I don't feel I'm getting a well-rounded kind of perspectives on
yes,
things.
But you chose that. You chose those sources. And if you want other sources, Facebook would be happy for you to like those other pages.
Well, you know, maybe
Twitter,
you chose,
only comes to you because you chose who you wanted to follow.
Well, no, not necessarily. You're choosing to click on a news story, and then an algorithm is deciding, well, this perspective is something he likes, when it may just have been you were curious about the headline, and now suddenly you're getting everything related to that particular perspective that you may not want.
But let's remember that your Twitter feed is what you chose to be in your feed.
Well, I'm talking about Facebook here.
Yeah. And what they're trying to do is give you more of what you like.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Well, I think
Look at your feed. Anybody can look at their feed and know what it is. You know, everybody, no doubt, says, I listen to Mindy every morning. All I ever listen to is public radio. But we would know whether or not that's what you do online by how many puppy videos you're looking at, because it's an aggregation of what you've already done.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, just piggybacking on what Al was saying about, you know, this is a time where we could be more enlightened, and I couldn't agree more with that. I think that people necessarily aren't. And in fact, if you do confront someone else with, facts or a different argument or what have you, that's the thing about fake news today. Immediately someone puts up the fake news wall. Well, that's fake news, what you said, or what you're presented with. You think, oh, that's fake news. And it's really created an entrenchment, I think, amongst folks or that's a bias source. And now you're drilling down trying to find out who's got the bias source. And I think that we have a real disconnect today, because I think the civil discourse that we once had and that exchange of ideas and the ability to consider what someone else says is wrapped now in this alternative facts universe and fake news universe, and people have just dug in and aren't willing to talk.
Yeah, I got a point there. Allison?
What exactly was that civil discourse? Because I never experienced it.
Well, at least there was a time where I think we were more likely to have these discussions face to face.
Exactly.
Now it seems like people don't even want to bring these issues up in a person-to-person way, would rather keep it on the social media.
And it's much easier.
It could also be that we never had these discussions, even face-to-face, and now we're having them online. They're more visible. We're writing what we've been thinking.
Maybe. All right, we got to take a break. Allison Butler will be joining Sean Corcoran for a panel discussion about fake news at the Falmouth Public Library on March 1st. We'll have more details at our website. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about journalism and fake news with Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI, Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief at the Cape Cod Times, and Al Tompkins, senior faculty in broadcast and online at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. John is calling from Orleans. John, thanks for holding.
Good morning. My point is, I think that the news media spends far too much time covering what happened and far too little covering what's important, the important issues in society. The most important ones are, is life on Earth going to survive? And it's threatened by climate change, it's threatened by nuclear proliferation. And the American people are poorly informed, and I think, of the important issues, and I think it's the news media's fault for not covering in sufficient depth those issues. The Point does a good job on getting specialists, but if I want talking about particular issues, if I want the truth, I have to go to books, or I have to go to particular experts on the media who write their own blogs. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for the call. Anybody want to chime in on that?
Well, I think.
Well, one thing I would say about first of all, we would like to clone John in so many ways. One of the things I would say, though, is don't lose faith in the human ability to gather information. I mean, our court systems are based on the jury being able to listen to evidence and weigh it on facts. Our election system is based on people being able to gather information over the course of a campaign and make good decisions, however they want to decide. And I believe that there are way more people like John than we might be willing to believe. I believe that there are people who are able to synthesize information and make good decisions. So we, as journalists, have the obligation to provide John the kind of information he wants in order to make fully formed opinions.
Yeah. Paul, go ahead.
Well, I just think that it raises a question of this. What is the media exactly? Because I think the media is such a broad brush term that we use too easily when, in fact, there are information. I mean, if John's talking about a newspaper or a particular radio program, maybe it isn't exactly doing the job because, you know, the job of a newspaper, for example, is to have, you know, the headline news. That is the most important news of the day is what a daily newspaper might provide. At the same time, your Sunday paper might have enterprise stories, and we've done a lot. He mentioned climate change. We've done quite a bit about climate change and other stories along those lines. But I think the media, again, you can unpack it in a lot of different directions. You have specialty media, everything from Sports Illustrated to Scientific American, that are going to focus on particular specialties. So if you are really engaged in a particular subject, it's out there. And I think especially in the digital space today, it's easy to find.
Last week, the president appeared to label journalists as enemies of the United States. And some journalists have said it's time to fight back, claiming that they need to push back against the administration and defend themselves as vigorously as they are being attacked. What are your thoughts on that? Al, let's start with you.
I think that President Trump needs an enemy and would rather not make Congress his enemy. So media are a terrific foil for him, and he knows that they will fight back but still cover him. You know, I think it's fascinating, for example, when he says, I saw this on TV. TV never covers that. You know, they never cover me, and yet they're covering him at the moment he's saying that. They never show the crowds at the moment that they're showing the crowds. It's just bizarre. But I would say that I think it's foolish to play his game and to spend all of our energy trying to say, no, we're not, because he's just going to say, yes, you are, and then what? So I'm not a big fan of spending all of our energy trying to say you're not right. Mm-hmm. But instead to provide evidence to the public that it really doesn't matter what he says about us. The fact is we're going to cover him, and we're going to cover him aggressively. And you need this information. You'll get it from us. And just don't spend so much time trying to say, no, you're not. I have been impressed, though, Mindy, that regular voices that you might align with the Republicans and with Trump specifically have spoken out reasonably forcefully against that whole idea of enemies. Chris Wallace, notably, on Fox, was pretty strong this weekend, I thought. So, you know, there are voices that have surprised me some around this. But truthfully, I think we ought to kind of get over it and move on. Presidents have attacked journalists for as long as they've been presidents and journalists. So, you know, that's kind of how it works.
Right, Paul?
Well, I think that certainly this president is working very hard to discredit the media, and that's frightening in many ways. I think, though, as I said earlier, the media need to be in it for the long game. And presidents come and go, people come and go, criticisms come and go. And even though the president is effectively declaring war on the media, I really liked what Marty Baron of The Washington Post said last week. He said, "We're not at war, we're at work. We're doing our job." And I think as long as we remember that, and Al touched on this too, as long as we remember to do our jobs well and to not be distracted by this noise, I think we'll be just fine. At the same time, I do think it's damaging for the president of the United States to make statements about the Fourth Estate, the people who uphold the First Amendment, to be the enemies of the state. This is not only damaging to us as an industry, but I think damaging it to us as a nation.
Sean?
Sure, I never thought I'd see the day when I would be labeled an enemy of America because of my job, certainly not with the First Amendment in its prominence. So, yes, it's a little bit frightening. We're not in a war, and we should not be pulled into a war. We shouldn't take that bait. We're dispassionate observers of the bombs and the bullets, rhetorical or otherwise. And as both my colleagues have said, this is the time to do your job, mm-hmm. time to do your job, perhaps better than you've ever done your job, and tell the truth, show people where information came from, show the evidence, lead with the truth, not with accusations, just do your job the best way you can.
Let me ask you a question, too, about going forward when we have people in the Trump administration with their so-called alternative facts and fake news. Don Lemon of CNN ended his show abruptly after one of his guests accused him of reporting fake news. They were basically talking about the cost of protecting the First Family. And there was, I can't remember who the Republican on the panel was, who said, yes, we have to do this, but can we do this more cost effectively? I think we can, while some of the others were criticizing the, you know, calling it hypocrisy. And then when the guest for the Trump administration said, this is fake news, and Don said, well, what's your definition of fake news? What's happening right here? And Don described what he saw as fake news. And when the guest continued down that line, he ended the show. And that we've heard people say, don't have Kellyanne Conway on if you think she's not going to give you valuable information. Al, what are you talking to journalists about how they move forward? What do you think about what Don Lemon did?
Well, I think that the show was ending. He had said that the show was ending, and the guest was sort of introducing a whole new controversy, which he's done before. And it was not an elegant way to end the show. In fact, I thought it was completely unnecessary to have that conflict there. But, you know, I think also Don Lemon also has his own presence and his own style. And, you know, it's sort of who he has become. So I sort of set that aside, especially the ending of that. The program was ending. His program was ending, and it couldn't have gone on much longer anyway, but he certainly could have closed it more elegantly. Look, I think that I've been thinking a lot about this, actually, and that is sort of where is the space for people to be who they are uniquely on media? And I think right now people are making their bets about whether or not it's going to be an audience attractor for them to be dichotomous, or whether it is to be sort of mainstream in the middle, trying to figure out, you know, all where all sides are coming from. And this is the time, it seems to me, where Fox News, for example, will dig itself into a position that probably will end up being prominently pro-Trump. And I think that it would be a really unwise decision for CNN or MSNBC to find themselves on sort of the other side of that. MSNBC, you know, during the Obama administration, found themselves leaning very liberal, and CNN tried to stake out the middle ground. I think it'd be really unwise at this point, from a marketing point of view, let alone a journalistic point of view, for them to find themselves way out there on one side or another. And that's one of the reasons, among about 100, that the Don Lemon thing really was unwise.
At the same time, I think what Don Lemon was doing is something you're going to see more and more with the media, that we are going to do our jobs, but we're going to do it aggressively, and we're going to call out things that are simply untrue, and call out things that, if an accusation is unfair, calling that out as well. And I remember Dean Banquet, the editor of the New York Times, tells a story about when he was at the LA Times during the Swift boat issues. He was having a discussion with one of his reporters about exactly how to frame that and how to frame it in a way that was appropriate for mainstream media to do it, so it wasn't revealing a bias. Fast forward to today, and the New York Times has called things lies, things you would never expect to see in a headline. And I think that you are going to see more and more of that in the media, where legitimate media journalists are unafraid to decide and choose how to have those discussions. And when you watch the Sunday morning talk shows, Chuck Todd, George Stephanopoulos, and others, not that those programs haven't always been somewhat abrasive and what have you, but I think now more than ever you're seeing them ask aggressive questioning. And that's, of course, the infamous alternative facts came up when Chuck Todd was grilling Kellyanne Conway. And I think credibility swings both ways. The media needs to maintain its credibility, and so do the sources, and that includes sources in the president's administration. You don't see Kellyanne Conway on television a lot since those days. I think she was on one other time, but I don't see her, not on every Sunday morning, that's for sure.
Yeah. We just have about a minute left. Sean, maybe you could talk a little bit. We heard Allison say that she thought maybe we might see more anonymous sources coming forward more. So maybe explain anonymous sources and how we deal with that when we're as journalists in our stories.
Well, every media organization has their own policy when it comes to anonymous sources, and usually it's a pretty high bar. Someone has to be in jeopardy in some way, or compassion must drive that decision about whether you're going to honor someone being anonymous. What happens in Washington is a whole different thing. As someone who covered Congress in Washington, I know the media is used, this anonymity is used to float different ideas, different policy that may or may not come forward. The Washington media has relied on anonymous sources for a long, long time. And so when it comes to these leaks, I'm not convinced we're going to see more leaking, despite any outrage among people in the cabinet or people working in the White House or in congressional committees, because they're going to go after these leakers as strongly as ever. And when the FBI goes after leakers, they generally find out who it is.
All right. Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI, Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief at the Cape Cod Times, and Al Tompkins, senior faculty in broadcast and online at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.